this is Sterling Allen with Free Energy Now. Thanks for joining us. We have a special guest with us today. We have Mark Holzapfel from the University, or actually Texas A&M. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself?
Great. You know, I really enjoyed watching your clips from your distinguished lecture series presentation. I guess it was in April?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, you were the last speaker of the year. How many do they do those every month, every week? How often do they have those?
There's five of them per year, and I was the finale, I guess. And it was quite an honor. They only have two speakers from Texas A&M. Most of the speakers are from outside. And I was the first engineer in 31 years to speak at the Distinguished Lecture. You know, usually engineers are pretty boring, so I don't usually like to have engineers on these things.
Well, your presentation was actually quite entertaining, I thought.
Well, thank you.
And it also was very informative. It reminded me, I haven't seen Al Gore's movie yet, I want to, but it reminded me of the caliber of information that I saw there.
Yes, one of the motivations I have for doing the work that I do is to try to reduce the effects of global warming. I recognize that global warming is a very controversial subject and people are usually very polarized on it. But I think the scientific evidence is pretty strong in support of global warming. And so we need to start figuring out how we're going to live in a world where we're constrained by carbon dioxide emissions.
Yeah, I found your presentation was, hold on just a second. Yes, I am. Sorry, I'm switching phones.
Hey.
I was out on a hike with my boy, and we were a little bit longer than what I planned, so we started this show on the cell phone, and I'm just switching over to my landline. I just got home.
Mm-hmm.
Are we on now? You there, Mark?
Yes, I am.
Yes, you're both on.
Okay, great. So, anyway, I was going to compliment you because on your presentation, you did a very good job of playing an even keel, even though there's a lot of information that would seem to support global warming. You presented it in a non-biased way, just basically saying, here's the data. You know, not sure what this is concluding, but it certainly does seem to indicate. In other words, you didn't downplay it, but you didn't milk it either. I thought that was good.
Well, I appreciate your recognizing that I try to be balanced. One of the approaches in science is you just gather data and let the data speak.
Mm-hmm.
And truth will come from the data, and that's what I did. Was I tried to as dispassionately as possible present the information, and see where that leads you. And then we really don't know what the effects of global warming will be. There's some potential positive and some potentially negative, but I think we just can't hope that the bad things won't happen. I think we have to plan and start altering our infrastructure so that we can address these problems.
Yeah. For the listener's sake, I just mentioned that what you did in your presentation is you basically presented the story of global warming and said we have a responsibility to do something about this on the planet. And then you basically came up with two major solutions that you're involved with. One is biomass, and the other is this star rotor technology where we could get somewhere between 2- and 3-fold increase in efficiencies in our fuel consumption.
Yes, I'm compelled to work the problem from both ends, come up with new fuels and simultaneously reduce the need for the fuels. And the reason I'm working the problem from both ends is that if you look at the amount of land area required to grow your biofuels, it's actually quite substantial. And so if you can increase the efficiency with which we propel our vehicles, it dramatically lowers the footprint or the land area that's required. So you really can't look at these problems as if you just do one thing, then you have the problem solved. You really have to do multiple things in order to work the problem.
That was very effective, that graphic that you showed of the United States, and then you showed the footprint of land required to grow enough biomass for a biomass-based fuel, and it was like a half the size of Texas.
That's right, and that was even assuming a pretty productive crop that was well irrigated. So one might argue that that's even optimistic, at least small.
Yeah.
So I think you have to reduce the amount of fuel that we consume.
Right. And that's where the star rotor came in. And you actually were not going after a fuel-efficient system when you were doing that. You were working on a air conditioning system. Is that correct?
That's right. Let me just give you a little background. I've always been interested in energy and fuels and engines and so forth. When I was in the Army, I was trying to develop a miniature air conditioning system that a soldier could wear so they wouldn't suffer from heat stress. And so that was kind of my first introduction into engines and air conditioning and so forth. So when I became a professor at Texas A&M, I pursued that as kind of a hobby. I was working on my own engine projects and air conditioning projects on the side, whereas my graduate students and my main research thrust was in the biomass area. And my hobby just kind of got out of hand. It turned into Star Rotor Corporation, and we've raised about $2 million so far to make it happen. And we've had some successes. We've built a compressor that shows great efficiency, and we want to move on to the next level, which is to build an engine. But to go back to the story, what happened was I was trying to develop an air conditioning system that uses what are called liquid piston Stirling engines, and it doesn't use any CFCs in it, so it would be an environmentally benign technology. And so I spent about $70,000 of my own money building these things, and it just wasn't working. And so I was commiserating with my colleague Dick Davison about how foolish I was to have spent $70,000 on a project that just didn't go anywhere. And literally in a matter of a half hour, we had invented what we thought was a brand new thermodynamic cycle based on water as a refrigerant for an air conditioning system. But the problem was that you needed a compressor that could process large volumes of water vapor to make it happen. And there was nothing on the market. In fact, there still is nothing on the market that can do that job. So we started thinking about compressors. And after about 5 years or so, I met a mechanical engineering student named Andrew Raybroker. And we were just kicking around a lot of ideas, and we settled on gyrotor technology as the way to process the large volumes of water vapor. And as soon as we solved that problem, a light went off in my head, and then I knew I could use that same technology to build an engine. So it was kind of bang, bang. Once we solved the air conditioning problem, it immediately knew I could use that to solve the engine technology. So it was kind of a catharsis, I would say.
Now, in the star rotor system, as you look at it, you have basically two concurrently rotating systems, and they are not pushing against each other. They're rotating at the same speed. Is that correct?
Well, you're almost correct. They one has to spin just a little bit faster than the other. There's two rotors. The outer rotor has the teeth on the inside, and the inner rotor has the teeth on it, the outside. So, and there's one less tooth on the inner rotor than the outer rotor. So as these two rotate, there's a gap or a void that opens up, and then it closes as the rotation continues. And so the inner rotor, being a little bit smaller, has to spin faster in order to keep up with the big one. But the main point is that there's no physical contact between the rotors. The motion is synchronized, and so that they don't touch. There's a very, very tiny gap. And yes, there's a little bit of leakage through the gap, but if you run it fast enough and keep the gap small enough, the leakage is really quite small.
So this would not necessarily work for a low torque or a low RPM, but it works fine in higher RPM?
Yes. The engine is inherently a high-speed engine, and when I say high-speed, I mean speeds of roughly 2,000 up to 10,000 RPM size for an automobile. Gas turbines at that size would operate around 100,000 RPM. So we have to make sure you understand that ours is not a super high speed like a gas turbine, but it's not as low a speed as you'd have for a piston engine.
In the lecture that you gave at the Distinguished Lecture, you had actually just barely gotten some data after a long time of, you know, $2 million worth of prototyping, and you presented that fresh to the audience. Remind us, what was the upshot of that data of, what was it, compressor number 5 you've built?
Yes. So the company is just a little over 5 years old, and in those 5 years, we went through five generations of compressors. The first generations took us longer, about a year or two in each generation, and now we've kind of got our momentum going. We've figured out how to do this, so it takes us about 3 to 4 months from the time we sit down and say we want to start a design until we finish it. About 4 months later, we have the hardware ready to test. And so what we have done is, we've gone through five generations, and in this most recent generation, we hit an efficiency of about 82%. And the implication of that is that an engine, car engine, would be roughly 55 to 65% efficient, which is about three times more efficient than a conventional automobile engine.
How are you able to go backward on that? Because this is a compressor and an engine is an expansion scenario.
Well, every engine has a compressor and an expander.
Mm-hmm.
You have to take the fluid and raise its pressure somehow, and then when the pressure drops, that's how you make your torque, get your power out of the engine. So you can look at let's take our conventional internal combustion engine. The piston comes down, it draws your air-fuel mixture in to the cylinder, and then the valve closes, and as it pushes up, now it's acting as a compressor. So you're squeezing and raising the pressure of your gas, your air-fuel mixture. And then close to top dead center, the spark goes off, you ignite the fuel, the pressure goes up even higher, and then you go through the expansion stroke. That's when you get the power out of the engine. And then the last part of the stroke is where you push the exhaust gas out of the engine. So the key features of an internal combustion engine are that you have a compressor, some sort of a combustion phenomenon, and then you have an expansion. And the star rotor engine has exactly the same features, a compressor, a combustor, and an expander. But what we do is we take those functions and we put them into separate pieces of equipment. So we have a separate compressor that's ideally designed to do compression really well, and then we have a separate combustor that does combustion really well, and then we have an expander that does expansion really well. And by separating those functions, you end up getting a much more efficient and long-lived engine. If you think about your internal combustion engine, going back to that, to be an efficient compressor, you want the gas to be cool. But to do an efficient combustion process, you want the gas to be hot. Well, how can you be both hot and cool in roughly the same volume at roughly the same time? It's impossible. And so, you know, the jacket, the walls of an internal combustion engine have cooling fluid flowing through them that ultimately goes to your radiator. And any fuel that's close to the wall is never going to burn because it's just too cool. So you're literally shoving unburned fuel out the exhaust of the engine, and then that's why you need the catalytic converters to clean up that mess that you made. And so in our case, we separate those functions, and we do a really good job of compression, a really good job of combustion, and a really good job of expansion.
And have you been able to demonstrate prototypically each one of those steps?
Yes, but not altogether. We built the compressor, as I mentioned. For fun, what we've done is we took our shop air compressor and put it at the outlet of the compressor and actually ran it backwards. So we've actually demonstrated that the device will work backwards as an expander, but we haven't yet demonstrated high temperature expansion. That's the next step for our company. And then as far as combustion is concerned, that's relatively simple technology. I mean, this combustors have been around for a long time, and so I won't trivialize the combustion process, but it's not as difficult as the compression or expansion function.
In other words, you're able to derive from a solid set of existing data in the field in general why this will work very efficiently.
Yeah, it's really pretty neat. Thermodynamics is a subject that lets you predict the future. If you know the conditions, temperatures and pressures and flow rates and so forth, you can go to thermodynamics, and it will tell you how much power you need or will make from a given system. So thermodynamics is an extraordinarily powerful field. In fact, I'm teaching thermodynamics at Texas A&M this semester, and it's a wonderful, wonderful field. I think it's one of the most powerful things that we teach our students. Now, there's one unknown, though, in the thermodynamic calculations, is you have to know the efficiency of the compressor and the efficiency of the expander. And you can do a fairly good job of estimating the efficiency by assuming a certain leakage rate and friction loss in the bearings and so forth. But you really don't know whether that efficiency can be realized until you build hardware. And so we've focused on building the compressor hardware. We measured efficiencies over 80% at only a 10 kilowatt scale, which is a very small compressor. And the efficiencies we're measuring are quite remarkable for such a small compressor. So once you know that number, once you know it's 82% efficient, you can take that number, plug it into your thermodynamic calculations, and then predict what the efficiency of the engine will be. Now, we will not know what the efficiency is until we actually build the engine and have hardware there and measure it in a dynamometer. But you'll get pretty close. That's the main missing number is that efficiency. Once you know that number, the rest of it's pretty straightforward.
I remember when we talked about a year ago, you were still at the stage of not having an expander. You had compressor technology that you'd proven. When do you think you'll have the expander built?
Well, I hate to talk about money, but that's really what it's all about is money. Mm-hmm. We are technically ready to start building the expander, but we have to raise roughly $1 to $2 million in order to build the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to start the project until I have, I guess I call it a war chest. I don't want to have a small amount of money and kind of go halfway down and then run out of money and have it fall apart. So we're in a fundraising mode right now.
I noticed in your presentation at the end you gave credit to the people who have been involved in your project in the last 5 years, and it was quite a list, a page full of names.
On the biomass side, there's roughly 20 or 25 master's students, a similar number of PhD students, and about 5 or 6 postdocs and 2 or 3 professors. So I guess that adds up to somewhere around 50 people have been involved on the biofuel side. On the engine side, it's a little bit smaller team. I have some absolutely wonderful people that I work with at Star Rotor. Andrew Raybroker, who I mentioned before, he was a graduate student at Texas A&M, and I enticed him to work with me at Star Rotor. Kyle Ross was one of my graduate students. He's a PhD chemical engineer, and he stayed in the community, and I enticed him to come work with me at Star Rotor. And then Nathan Okonski, he recently graduated from Texas A&M. He's has an engineering degree in manufacturing. And so he's our machinist, and he's very, very skilled. Because the only way we can make this technology work is to make our parts at very high precision and accuracy. We acquired a mill about a year ago that's so accurate you could literally take a human hair and slice it 64 times.
Wow.
So that's the level of precision and accuracy that we're shooting for in order to get the leakage low and get the that's how we get our high performance is by making our parts to very, very high accuracy and precision.
Are those CNC machines?
Yes, we have 2 CNC machines. The first one was accurate to about 1/1 of an inch. If you went through a lot of gyrations, you'd have to literally lie to the machine to get it to do what you wanted it to do. And that turned out to be a very slow and painful way of making our parts. So we acquired a mill that's much more accurate by design. It's just inherent in the machine, and that's made our life much easier. We were able to increase our parts production dramatically. I'm not exaggerating at all. It used to sometimes take us 1 or 2 months to make a single part on the older machine, and now we can make a part sometimes in a day, and sometimes it takes a couple days. But that's roughly a 10 or 30-fold increase in productivity just by having the right tools, having this right machine.
One of my best friends runs a machine shop. He's a PhD mechanical engineer, so I've been around that kind of stuff a little bit. He made a really nice gizmo for us one time, a quarter-scale magnet motor. But I have to tell you, along the lines of anecdotes, to find your technology is really quite fun for me because I had my start in alternative energy in earnest about 4 or 5 years ago. And one of the stories you hear about is these high-efficiency carburetors that, through a number of different mechanisms, will enable you to get twofold increase in your mileage. And it kind of falls into the category of urban legends, because how many people have actually seen one of these things? But allegedly, one of the ways that they're able to accomplish this is by taking the exhaust heat and preheating the fuel before it goes into the combustor.
Mm-hmm.
And that the problem with that method is that you have some high pressures and highly volatile situations, so that you can have explosions. And I had a friend that actually was giving lectures every week at a university along these lines. He wasn't with the university, but he was using their facilities. And he was actually sabotaged one time. Two guys came into the presentation, clean-cut guys, took him out to dinner. One of them excused himself to go to the bathroom, took quite a while, came back. And as my friend was driving away that night, his car actually, the engine blew up, started the car on fire. And as he did some retrospective diagnostics, he found that the pressure release valve had been clamped down. And so he still has the plans for this design, but has been reluctant to do anything with it. And if I can understand right, your technology is using a similar principle, but you're keeping it all within a chamber that is well suited to be able to handle those kinds of pressures.
Well, you presented a number of ideas, so let me see if I can tease them apart. When I was a freshman in college, the year was 1974, and you may, I don't know how old you are, but 1973 was when the first oil crisis started. That's when the Arabs reduced the oil supply and caused the price to increase dramatically.
It would have been about 10 or 11 at that time.
Okay, so you probably weren't paying too much attention to that. but to me, it made a huge impact. And so one of my dorm mates, who was right across the hall from me, was telling me about these carburetors that get 200 miles per gallon, and it made me mad, because you know, here we needed paying huge prices for energy. People were talking about going to war over energy, and you know, these 200 mile per gallon carburetors were being taken away from us. So I wanted to know more about it. And where did he find out about this? So he said, well, my dad told me. I said, well, I want to know. I want more information. And when he dug a little bit deeper, it didn't go anywhere. And so I think it is one of those urban legends. A carburetor alone can't do that much, because even though I mentioned that some of the fuel gets by unburned, it's really just a couple percent. So I don't know the exact number, but maybe 2 or 3% of the fuel is unburned. So you know, the best that a carburetor could do would be to increase your efficiency by just a tiny amount by burning all of the fuel. So that's one point to be made. Now, I guess there's a lean burn technology where you can reduce the amount of fuel that's added, and that will probably get you another, I don't know, 10 or 20% efficiency. And you also mentioned preheating the fuel to vaporize the fuel. And actually, one of my colleagues, Dick Davison, whom I mentioned before, was vaporizing methanol and adding methanol vapors to internal combustion engines. And that would also, in some ways, enhance your efficiency. But the latent heat of vaporization is pretty small compared to the heat of combustion, so I wouldn't expect it to have that dramatic an effect. Again, it would be, you know, a couple percent here and there is what you might be talking about. The major inefficiency of an automobile engine, current engines, is that you are sending out the tailpipe exhaust that's really quite hot. If I asked you to put your hand on the exhaust manifold of an automobile engine, I think you would say I was crazy, because literally you can cause those manifolds to glow cherry red. They're so hot. And that means that you're dumping energy out the tailpipe that you're not turning into work. So one of the main things about Star Rotor, which I haven't mentioned before, is that we actually put a heat exchanger and take the energy out of the exhaust gas and use it to preheat the air before it goes into the combustor. So essentially what you're doing is taking the load off the combustor and putting it onto this heat exchanger, where you're getting essentially free waste heat that normally would have just gone out the tailpipe. And so that has a very, very dramatic effect on so reducing the fuel requirements because you're preheating the air.
And the air then hits the fuel and immediately heats the fuel up.
Yes, and the fuel would of course add even more energy to the air and cause the temperature to rise even higher. And so the whole idea of the engine is you want high pressure, hot air going into the expander, and that's where you get the energy in the expansion process, is from that high pressure, high temperature air. And as it goes through the expander, as you remove energy from the air, it drops the temperature a little bit, but you still have pretty hot air coming out of the engine, out of the expander, and that's why we need that heat exchanger to try to capture that waste heat and give it another chance to go through and make work out of it.
And as we were mentioning earlier, you're still trying to pull together some funds to actually build this design to prove with a prototype that this does indeed work.
Yeah, we've got some approaches to it. It was very gratifying, actually. A Navy person from the Navy contacted me and said, my boss saw your website and he really likes what you're doing, and he's tasked me with trying to make it happen. So I don't know whether it will happen or not, but we wrote a proposal to the Navy, and it's floating around somewhere in there. Hopefully we'll get some money out of that.
Oh.
So that's, I guess, our current approach is to see if we can get some military funding. And
would abscond the technology from the civilian sector, or would it be available for the civilian sector as well?
Well, normally when you have projects that are developed through the military is that they reserve the right to use your technology royalty-free, because if they paid for the development of it, then they don't consider it fair, and I agree with them, that they shouldn't also have to pay royalties later on. So that's what I would expect to happen, is if they do fund the development of the engine, that they would expect to be able to use it royalty-free. And I'd be glad to sell it to them royalty-free, if that's what it takes to get the engine born and to have it actually working. The military is an interesting organization when it comes to engines, because I'm told at the battlefront, fuel is worth about $100 a gallon. And that sounds like an enormous number, but this is the logic behind it. When they buy the gasoline, or actually more of a diesel fuel, they buy it for a couple dollars a gallon, just like everybody else does. But then they have the task of bringing it to the battlefront using tankers. And so it takes a lot of people to run those tankers, a lot of logistics. And I've heard a variety of estimates, but the number that comes up most of the time is somewhere around $100 a gallon is what it costs for fuel at the battlefront. And so if you have an engine that's a lot more efficient, that has a dramatic effect in the military. And you could even imagine the difference between winning a war and losing a war based on fuel efficiency. It's an interesting statistic that in World War II, the battle tanks could drive about 250 miles on a charge of fuel, and then they'd have to stop and wait for the logistic tail to come up behind and refuel the tanks. And as you might imagine, those tankers are not armored, and the enemy would try to shoot the tanks and blow up the fuel tanks on the way. So you really can't move more than about 250 miles without refueling. And it turns out the M1A1 Abrams tank that the Army uses has a range of 250 miles. So even though roughly 50 years have passed, the range of the tanks has not changed. So if you could have a tank that, let's say, had a double the fuel economy and it could go 500 miles, that would have a big implication to the military.
We had a story on our site the day before yesterday, I believe, out of the military, saying that the military is actually looking for some alternative energy technology so that they can eliminate, I think some numbers say 80% of the supply line is tied up in fuel. In other words, getting fuel down to the end player. And my friend Dave Muckow is the CEO, or Muckow, I think is how you pronounce his name, M-U-C-H-O-W, with Skybuilt. And they have basically a Dell approach to solar, wind, where they use a shipping container that has basically the ability to plug this or that component into it. Do you need a battery of banks? You need X amount of solar. You need rapid deploy, slow deploy. You need cheap. You know, whatever your parameters are, they can basically tailor make a system for you with this plug and play type of thing. And one of their primary customers is the military, because they can get these things out there and they can use it for basically the end of the line power supplies, so they don't have to have this supply line as, you know, as much of a supply line need. And so you're talking about the same thing, using the approach of actually reducing the amount of fuel that they require for the things that are using fuel.
Yeah, I don't know fully the logistics, but water and fuel are some of the main things that the military has to move. Of course, ammunition would be the other thing. But fuel and water are very, very important things that allow the military to function.
Yeah, this amounts to saving lives, because, I mean, how many stories do we hear about convoys in Iraq being subject to car bombs or whatever and soldiers dying? And if we can eliminate or cut down the amount of supply line needs, then that saves lives.
And some other features of our engine that we think the military will find attractive is it's very compact, rough numbers about half the size of a conventional engine, roughly half the weight. You can use any fuel you want. So if in the military case, if you don't have diesel fuel and you ran across some olive oil, you can put olive oil into the engine. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. You can use multiple fuels in your system. Why is that? How does that work?
Well, really all we need is a source of heat. And so a burner can be made to be, let's go back again to the internal combustion engine. A gasoline engine, the important property of the gasoline is it doesn't pre-ignite. When the piston is coming up and the temperature is rising, if the fuel were to spontaneously combust, it would be fighting your piston as it's moving up. So they purposely design gasoline so it does not pre-ignite, and that characteristic is quantified with the octane number. So you want a high octane fuel so you can have a high compression engine and doesn't pre-ignite. A diesel fuel is kind of the opposite. What you want to happen in the diesel fuel is for the molecule to crack apart and burn when it gets compressed. So you specially design diesel fuel so that it does ignite pretty easily when it gets hot during the compression. And if you try to put diesel fuel in a gasoline engine or vice versa, you'll have a mess because the two systems are incompatible with each other. Now, in the case of the Star Rotor engine, the combustor doesn't really care that much what the fuel is. As long as it's got BTUs in it, it'll burn just fine. So you could literally have a tank of, let's say, methanol in your vehicle and a tank of diesel fuel and switch from one to the other, and the engine wouldn't care. It just would just
keep
going.
As I look at this Star Rotor design, you have an artist rendition, and you basically have, as you said, there's these two rotating components, two rotors. One is has five or an extra set of teeth compared to the inner one. Is the explosion taking place within that area, or where is it taking place?
No, that's just there's no explosion in the engine, which I think is very nice. You don't have that dramatic shock that comes from an explosion. Recall that we have three devices, separate devices: a compressor, a combustor, and an expander. So the combustion of the fuel actually occurs between the rotating devices in a separate device. So what happens in the combustor is the gas gets hot, and in fact the volume expands because the gas gets hotter. And then you feed that hot high pressure gas into the expander, you expand it even more, and that's where you extract the work out of it. So the combustion function,
so to speak,
occurs before you go to the expander.
Is there an action of explosion?
No, the combustor, you just have a flame in there. There's a number of different combustors that we're considering, but one of them is a catalytic combustor. And what you do is you have a catalyst in there, and when you put your fuel on the catalyst, it just ignites, and you just have this glowing flame that's stable attached to the catalyst.
So the incoming fuel is coming at the beginning of the cycle, and it's expanding, and by the time it gets to the end, it's all burned out, and that then goes into the exhaust, heats the incoming air.
Well, the fuel combustion it happens in its entirety in the combustor, so it only takes literally a few milliseconds for the fuel to burn. And so coming out of the combustor is, assuming you put a hydrocarbon as your fuel, you have some carbon dioxide and water in addition to the air. And so that mixture of CO2, water, and air is what goes into the expander. And that's where, the work is actually produced. But the combustion is complete. There's no more chemical reaction occurring in the expander. By the time the gas gets into the expander, the reaction is complete. And that's very different from the internal combustion engine. You can actually have combustion occurring during the expansion process in an internal combustion engine.
And there's really no compression cycle for the gas?
In the case of the star rotor engine?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely there's compression cycle. We have the compressor is the very first piece of hardware that the gas has to go to. So the air comes in, it's compressed. You preheat it using the waste heat from the exhaust, add fuel in the combustor, and then that hot, high-pressure gas goes to the expander, and that's where the work is produced.
Okay. I might mention, just for the listener's sake, we do have a call-in number.
Mm-hmm.
I just realized that I had it tied up with my cell phone in making the switch from the cell phone to my phone, and we have Xenia, who is going to be calling in. If she's listening, then she can go ahead and call in. I've just connected that other line. And if people want to call in with questions, they can do so at the following numbers. Call toll-free 877-876-5227. That's in the U.S. And Canadians can call 888-810-8322. And if you're outside of either one of those places, you can call 530-876-3222. We're talking to Mark Holtzapfel. He is a professor of chemistry, is that correct?
Chemical engineering.
Chemical engineering down at Texas A&M. And another thing we've not mentioned, you're featured in the current issue of Popular Science.
Yes, that's right. Thank you for mentioning that. We're very excited about that. There's something called the X Prize, where they're trying to get vehicles that go over 100 miles per gallon. And they featured three technologies that they consider to be contenders for that. And Star Rotor was the engine technology that they featured. So we were quite honored to have our engine appear in Popular Science this month.
Yeah, I've actually been getting a fair amount of traffic on our feature page about your technology because of their article. People Googling Star Rotor are going to find our site. We come up fairly high in
mm-hmm.
the Google search. That was a fairly short and sweet article, and then they also had a podcast that was quite humorous about the Star Rotor. And
I haven't seen the podcast. Some friends of mine told me about it. I couldn't figure out how to get it to work on my computer, so I gave up, but they figured it out.
Yeah,
they said the guy didn't really quite understand what we were doing very well, so I'm not sure that the podcast is the best way to get information about Star Rotor
engines. No, it wasn't. It was fun. It was entertaining, but not very informative. It's kind of an end-of-the-day relaxation type of thing in terms of its flavor. But your presentation there, I'm almost done. I'm to the Q&A session. I wasn't able to complete the whole thing. Very well done. I'm going to be featuring that in our news tomorrow that you did there, and recommending anyone who has any interest in biofuel and engine technologies. It's kind of a must-see type of presentation. Very well done.
I appreciate that. I worked hard on it, as you might imagine, and I was really honored that they had selected me for the distinguished lecturer, and they videotaped it, and so it's on the web, and anybody can look at it any time that they want.
Oh, and it's really slick too. I mean, you click on the page and it immediately starts playing. There's no load time. The way they've got it, it's one of the slickest presentations I've ever seen. And as you go through, what I did, and I think they recommend that you do this, is you've got your PowerPoint presentation in one browser. I pull that up, and then I had your video presentation going in the other browser.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could kind of go back and forth. There's a couple times when the animations weren't working for me in my system, you know, whatever settings I had were keeping them from playing, but I could see the video from the other screen where I could see the engine animations as you were describing different things, and that was very good to go be able to jump back and forth. Sometimes the video, you couldn't see the details on the overhead, and I could go over to the PowerPoint and I could see the details, and so that worked really well to be toggling back and forth between those two.
I'm glad you like that. I appreciate your making those comments, and I'll pass them on to the web guy that put it all together.
I noticed, too, that they have actually done some kind of a transcript on the PowerPoint presentation so that you have in the upper frame the PowerPoint, and then in the bottom frame you actually have some text that is describing what you're seeing. Makes it quite... And I noticed also the labeling in the left-hand field. They have a left-hand column. They have all 223 slides indexed, and I found it quite easy... the names that they had given, and maybe that was the naming that you gave of the files, to be able to kind of, as I was going back and forth between the two programs, to be able to hone in on what particular slide you were looking at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Those animations helped me understand better how your technology works. Let me ask you this question.
Sure.
As you know, I'm involved in the New Energy Congress, which we founded last September, about a year ago, and you know, that's 40 plus professionals from the energy industry who are looking at any kind of cutting edge energy technology, and we've had your technology in our top 100 listing I think since the beginning, and there are a lot of technologies that are pushing the envelope to burn fuel more efficiently, and some that even are providing alternatives to burning fuel, that mechanisms for propelling vehicles down the road, or even some anti-gravity technology. You obviously are honing in on these technologies, but I'm sure you're keeping your ear to the ground, so to speak, to other things going on. What is catching your attention right now that you see out there in the world, without using the word competition, but just mm-hmm. other people that are doing in the same ballpark is seeking alternative and better ways to burn fuel and alternatives to burning fuel?
Well, I guess it's pretty common that people will send me emails regarding various engine technologies. Star Rotor maintains a website, and anybody can contact me just by clicking on contact at starrotor.com. And so, you know, a couple times a week people will send me web links to engines, and there's a lot of really fascinating things out there, very what I would call intricate or complicated mechanisms for implementing the internal combustion engine, just a different mechanisms than what we have with our pistons and crankshaft, and it's amazing to me the ingenuity of people that are out there, all the different approaches and ideas that people have to building engines.
Now, your system is fairly simple. Isn't that one of the, I guess, sell points of the Star Rotor technology?
Yes, exactly. I'm a pretty simple guy. I like things that are simple. There's an engineering principle called the KISS principle. Have you ever heard of it before?
Yeah, keep it simple, stupid.
Keep it simple, stupid, right. So
when people tell me it's keep it simple, Sterling, so...
Well, I'm a great believer in that, and I'll just give you a little story. When I was in the Army and trying to develop this miniature air conditioning system, I worked with some very, very talented engineers in Richland, Washington, that built Stirling engines. And they said, you know, if it looks simple, it's hard, and if it looks hard, it's impossible. So when you look at the Star Rotor technology, it looks pretty simple, which means it's hard to actually build. And that, in fact, that's what we found, is that it took us 5 years to figure out how to build these things. And you look at it and say, well, that looks pretty straightforward. probably could do it in a couple months, and the reality was it took about 5 years to figure it out.
Well, that was interesting. In your PowerPoint presentation, you referred to a historical parallel. What system was it? It took 20 years from the time...
Oh, the television.
Television.
Philo T. Farnsworth invented the television, I think it was 1927, if I remember right. I think that was the year. And, of course, he had to go through the Depression and World War II, so that, I imagine, slowed him down a little bit. But it wasn't until 1947, exactly 20 years later, that the first television started, wealthy people had a few televisions in New York City. Very, very, very small market penetration. And it took another 20 or 30 years before you would say we had saturation. So it was literally 50 years from the time he invented the technology until it was fully implemented in society.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the nature of any energy technology. The amount of capital infrastructure when you come to energy technology is enormous. I mean, think about all the oil refineries and the super tankers and the gas stations and the drilling rigs and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there's literally trillions and trillions of dollars tied up in our energy infrastructure. And then if you think about automobiles, all the car factories and all the existing infrastructure that we have, I think there's like 500 million automobiles on the planet. You don't change that infrastructure by snapping your fingers. It takes decades and decades to alter. It's like driving a aircraft carrier. You don't decide that you're just going to stop or turn on a dime. Those things have enormous amounts of inertia.
Mm-hmm.
And so my expectation is that it'll take decades before the transformation is made. But
well,
that means we have to start now.
One of the things you have going for you is that the politics of science is going to be less for you than it might be if, say, you were a garage mechanic coming up with this idea. You're from a university, you're a professor, you have a air of credibility about you that's going to probably shave 5 years off of that time frame from you, I would think.
I would hope so. I mean, you never really know how things will work out, but I thank you for noticing that. The fact that I am a professor and there's a certain amount of sorting that goes through. I mean, they don't let just anybody be a professor. You have to get tenure and publish papers and teach students, and there's a lot of filtering that goes on.
Well, and Texas A&M is no small university either. That's got a name. Isn't it like in the top 100 of universities in the United States?
Actually, among engineering, it's in the, I think the engineering college is the top 13 in the nation. So it's well recognized for its engineering.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that it does bring a little bit of credibility. It's pretty common that you'll hear people talking about really high efficiency engines, and in fact, that is one of the problems that I have to overcome, is that there have been so many people before me making claims about high-efficiency engines that it's pretty common for people just to dismiss as, you know, another wacky professor talking about the future. But I assure you that we've done this very, very carefully. It's a very, very high caliber of people that are working at Star Rotor. We've been extremely careful in how we make our measurements. It literally took us 6 to 9 months to figure out how to get the accurate measurements of the compressor efficiency, so that the numbers I'm quoting are not just something that we kind of threw together. It was done with a great deal of care. And so we firmly believe that what we're saying is true, and we're working very hard to prove that it's in fact true.
I'm wondering about this, here you are a professor, and usually that's considered a, quote, full-time job, and you're also the CEO of Star Rotor, and that's also considered a, quote, full-time job. How does that work?
Well, notice that I'm speaking on the radio on a Saturday afternoon. So the way I do it is I really am working two full-time jobs. People that get emails from me say, well, you sent me an email at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, yeah, that's when I get my work done. So I really am running two full-time jobs trying to make everything happen. It's just the nature of my life. Where I am right now, it's what it takes to get things done.
once Star Rotor really takes off, would you see yourself either handing the baton to somebody else or leaving the university? How would you do that?
It's hard to know what the future holds. I really love teaching. I love being at the university. I love having all this knowledge available at my fingertips. I mean, I have wonderful colleagues at the university that I can think of almost any topic and find somebody at the university I can interact with and play with. On the other hand, you know, Star Rotor is a big responsibility and is moving forward. We've got customers now for compressors, and so we're making the transition from an R&D prototype shop to a business, mm-hmm. and so that does take more responsibility. I guess the future will figure out how I manage that. I hope to stay engaged with both. I think it's possible. But,
one thing that we've not gone into here, and we've got about 3 minutes left.
Okay.
Could we do a crash course on biofuels? Tell us what you're doing there. That was fascinating.
Sure. What we're doing is we're taking any biomass that's biodegradable, so anything that if you put it outside and it rotted, we can use that as our feedstock. And so that would include things like garbage and sewage sludge, manure, energy crops, crop residues. And the first thing we do is we treat it with lime to make it digestible. Lime is a very common chemical. Farmers often put it on their field to keep the soil alkaline. We treat it with lime for about a month in combination with air, the oxygen in the air. And those two things knock out the lignin, which is what makes biomass non-degradable. Then we throw soil onto the biomass, and the organisms in the soil in an anaerobic environment produce organic acids, such as acetic acid, propionic, and butyric acid. And then those acids are concentrated, and using chemistry, we convert those acids into a whole variety of products, including alcohol fuels, the acids themselves, ketones, aldehydes, and esters. So there are many, many products that can be made. And so I envision that in the future we'll have a bio-based economy rather than a petroleum-based economy. That future will take many decades to occur. But we might as well get started now.
Yeah, as I was on a walk with my boy today, going up the mountains, you can look down into the valley where I live, and there are about 20 farm plots. You can see the little circles in the ground. And I was thinking about your lecture where you were talking about a 20-mile radius
mm-hmm.
could supply a central location with the biomass necessary to provide the fuel for it, you know, X amount of people. And I was picturing myself going to the city council and saying, hey, you got to go watch this lecture, and them giving you a call. And, you know, 5 years down the road, we have one of those around here where we're making our own fuel.
Where do you live?
I'm in Utah.
Okay.
Outside of Salt Lake. We're in a valley separated from Salt Lake, so we have some farming communities out here.
Well, I hope that's will be part of the future. I really believe that we need to become more energy self-sufficient and more self-sufficient, that if communities can produce their own fuels, I think that'll be good for the economy. That right now we spend, this is not an exaggeration, it's about $1 billion a day going overseas to import oil. And could you imagine $1 billion a day being fed back into the U.S. economy and not being sent overseas? That would be a tremendous benefit.
Indeed. So you're both on the supply and the usage end, making a device, the Star Rotor, that can use any kind of fuel, gaseous or liquid, on the combustion end, the burning end, to provide the heat to turn the rotor at a 2 to 3-fold increase in efficiency over our present usage of fuels. Which are limited to just gasoline. So you broaden it to any kind of fuel. And then on the other end, you're working on actually creating the fuel. So definitely a man for our day. We appreciate all that you're doing.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity you gave me to explain to your public what we're working at. And I'd encourage people to visit our website, starrotor.com, to learn more about the engine technology and the compressor technology. And I guess you'll post the link to the distinguished lecture. Is that correct?
Yeah. We've got that. If you Google starrotor.com, your website comes up first. I think our PES Weekly coverage comes up second, and I have a link there about two-thirds of the way down where I have a link to your lecture and the videos and the PowerPoint presentation. So I'd highly recommend people that they take a look. Isn't it about an hour long?
Yes. I did all 230 slides, whatever it was, in 55 minutes.
And it didn't even feel rushed. It was very well done, and it was a well-deserved standing ovation. And if our audience was here in the room with us, I think they would probably give you the same. Thanks for being honest with us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. That's been Mark Holtzapfel. How do you pronounce your last name?
Holtzapfel.
Holtzapfel. With freeenergynow.net, if you want to join us next week, we have a different speaker each week. And thanks again, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care.
All right. Thank you.